Historian Jeremy Suri says the bad news is American democracy has always been a work in progress. But don't despair. As he told Charles Monroe Cain, that's also the good news.
You know, I'm among those historians who see democracy as a roller coaster. It goes up and down. Mm-hmm. It's not a straight line. We like to think that every generation gets better at this thing called democracy. It's not true. Some generations, because of their circumstances, do better, and some don't. And we're at a low point, but we're moving to a high point, I think, right now. We're at a low point in participation. We're at a low point in engagement, and we're in a low point in the rotation of power. All those things, the way they operate in our society today, our founders would be astounded and dismayed. But I feel like we're climbing back up again now. The Black Lives Matter movement was the largest social movement in American history. Almost all the activities were peaceful, and they involved more white people than black people, in fact. That's engagement. That's what democracy is about. And this is often the case, Charles, that in our low moments, it's the marginalized groups that lead us back up the hill of democracy.
Okay. I smelled hope leaning forward. But then I start thinking about Jim Crow, voting under Jim Crow, you know, poll tax and having to read the Constitution or memorize the Bill of Rights before you can vote, which went on for quite a long time. My cynical hat says, have things really gotten better? Aren't we living in times like that right now?
Well, I think they've gotten better and worse at the same time, and that's the dynamic of history. Hegel called this dialectics, right?
Right.
At the moment when you see the greatest change, you also see the greatest resistance. So let's take the American South that you just talked about. You're absolutely right. And I've written, actually, a number of things. In fact, that the governor is very angry at me here in Texas because I said that he's actually practicing Jim Crow in his efforts to restrict voting, using the same language, in fact. But why is he doing that? He's doing that because Texas, like many other states, is on the verge of becoming a majority-minority state with more and more voters who are not your traditional Texan voters or your traditional Southern voters. They are more active and engaged than they've ever been, and they don't support the parties in power. So you're seeing those in power trying wherever they can to hold this inevitable push back. And that's the space we're in now. In some ways, those who are trying to repress the vote, and they definitely are today, they're fighting their Alamo. You know, this is their last stand because they know after we get more voters in, they're out.
You know, I'm sitting here, I kind of got the Alamo stuck on my head, and I started thinking about some of the details and how long it was and how many people died. Do we really have to go through all this pain to get there?
Unfortunately, yes. I think if there's one truism about American history, it's that peaceful change is a myth. We're a very violent society. We don't teach it that way. We're a very, very violent society. Even the Congressional Research Service has pointed out that there are very few years in our entire history when we have not been at war. We don't always call it war, but if you define war as the organized use of violence against a group defined as a threat, we have the highest incarceration rate of any peer society. That's a kind of violence, right? We're a very violent society, and people in our society have never given up power peacefully. The process of historical change is always painful, and that is precisely what we're living through right now. And the 200,000 plus people who have died from COVID are casualties of that war right now that we're fighting.
I want to talk about something that's not so practical, and that is confidence. Let me give you an example, and I think this example scares me. My wife, who happens to work in government, she and I filled out our absentee ballots weeks ago, and I was going to mail them. I actually had them in the mailbox in the front of our house. And my wife said, no. What if they don't get counted? So she took them to the local clerk and had them stamped, and then you get a little number telling you, like a serial number of where it went. She wasn't confident that it would make it through the mail system and get counted. I think that's really scary that she's actually worried that her vote's not going to get counted that way.
Well, I think, first of all, this is not a new phenomenon. It's new to us who lived through the last 35, 40 years when we had pretty fair elections. But, you know, our elections have always been fraught with politics and efforts to count some ballots and not others. Lyndon Johnson, when he was elected to the Senate in 1948, he was famously known as Landslide Lyndon because there was a county in Texas where these dead people seemed to vote for him in alphabetical order, in fact. So this is... So this is not a new phenomenon, but it is a case where we have the opportunity to make progress. And the way to make progress is to do exactly what your wife did, not just take your ballot somewhere where you know it will be received, but to actually track our voting. That is how it worked in the 19th century. When the elections were small enough, you would actually vote and you would see that your vote was counted.
Right. You know, the majority of American voting age Americans don't vote. What do you do with those people?
So in the late 19th century, we actually had very high voter turnout rates. We had about 80%.
Wow.
Now, of course, it was a bounded electorate. It was white males for the most part. Right. So it really wasn't 80% of the population. But the things they did to make that possible, we could do again today for a larger electorate. In the late 19th century, you didn't have to register to vote. You just went and voted and proved that you were who you were, or you could register the day of. In that period, you were able to leave work to go vote. It was
right.
It was not an official holiday, but there was the presumption that actually you went because they wanted you to vote for their guy or whoever the company was or the local union was. So, you know, if we made, as we're starting to this year, right, if we made, many companies are doing this, right, if you make Election Day a holiday, if you make it easier to register, and we could also say that it's actually a constitutional duty and require one to go to vote. Australia does that.
Yeah, that would be interesting, right?
And you could still then go to vote and vote none of the above. You would not be forced to make a choice you don't want to make. I think people should have the right to vote none of the above, but you would still have to actually go and vote. And maybe that's the route we want to go.
I have two questions for you that I've been thinking about a lot. And the first one is, Donald Trump wins the election. It's the 20th of January. There's no transition of power. What does it look like in America if there's no longer democracy?
Well, I don't think the election of Donald Trump would be the end of democracy, but it would sink us very deeply into a violent, conflictual moment, because many of his efforts are an attack upon what people believe are democratic rights, the right to speak, their right to have honest news and information, their right to have some access to health insurance, their right for their state not to be mistreated because the president doesn't like the governor. And I think we're on the edge of people then massively responding through disobedience and through possible violence. It wouldn't be the end of democracy, but it would become a very violent moment in our democracy. We're on the edge of that now, in fact.
Wow, that's, I can't believe we're having this conversation. I think I know how you're going to answer this, but I want to ask you, I find it hard to believe America, arguably the most powerful country in the history of the world, it makes me feel like our democracy is weak if it can't handle fill in the blank. How come we can't handle this?
Well, I don't think it is because of Trump. He's definitely the most anti-democratic president we have ever had. But we have come to this point because of all the people who have enabled him. The Republicans in the Senate who have not been willing to hold him accountable. One can have one's own opinion on impeachment and conviction. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about requiring that the executive agencies that work for the president don't do his political bidding, but instead do their jobs. The Justice Department has been manipulated by the Attorney General. Every single director of the Department of Homeland Security since this one, and this one was not even legally appointed, every one of them, including Republican Tom Ridge, who is very close to George W. Bush, have said the Department of Homeland Security is not doing its job. It's acting as the goons for the president. And we could go on and on with a long list of that. All of these agencies, they get every dollar from Congress. And the Republicans have been unwilling to hold them accountable. They are the ones to blame. You want to protect our democracy, get people in the Senate who actually care about democracy and are not stooges to a party.
Yeah, it's so interesting to think about it. I had a friend who was like, you know, what Trump's done for us is a favor. He's exposed all the holes in the dike we need to fix.
Yes.
Do you feel like maybe that's the silver lining as well? We're like, hey, okay.
Absolutely. That's why I think we can do better. The horrible moment exposes, as you said, the rot, and it mobilizes us to do something about it. That's why George Floyd mattered. That's why Bull Connor mattered in the 1960s, right? That's why the Selma March was so important, right? When they beat John Lewis and those peaceful civil rights activists walking across Edmund Pettus Bridge, it showed the world how horrible this was. You couldn't pretend it wasn't there anymore. When George Floyd was lynched in front of us all, You can no longer deny that there's a problem of police brutality. And so we have to act now. We can't pretend it's not there. Trump has done that for us, and that is the engine of change. We can pretend things are fine until it's pushed in our face. This is what Martin Luther King understood, that you have to expose in order to motivate.
You know, it's funny. I didn't think you were going to be this optimistic in the interview, but then I started thinking while you were talking, oh, you're a historian. You're basing things on the history of America. Most people are looking to the future, right? Oh my God, this could happen, this could happen. Is that what you find that history is makes one optimistic because things tend to work themselves out?
So I became a historian because I think what history shows us is that every moment that we're in is filled with all different kinds of potential. And that potential comes from a long past that we don't see. One of the problems of not seeing history is you underrate the options that you have. You think all you can do is what's in front of you. And by looking back, it's not that you will replay the past, but is that the past widens the range of possibility for the present because you can learn from what others have been through and see possibilities in your own world. And I think when we look into the American past, we can see that our democracy has been a roller coaster. We've had some terrible moments, not just the Civil War, Jim Crow, the Great Depression. And we have made it through not with Pollyannish thinking. We've made it through because those moments have mobilized people, often non-traditional actors, often young people, to get involved and force change into the future. And that's where we are today. And if we can get through this moment, we can start to do that good work.
Wow. I was ready for a different interview. I was ready for something more dark and more negative. And I find your optimism refreshing. So thank you very much.
My pleasure. I do think we're on the cusp of a positive turning point, and we just have to get ourselves through it. And if we don't, it'll be disastrous.
So there you go. The stakes are low.
Exactly.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you, Charles.
I got to keep moving, moving.
Jeremy Suri is a historian at the University of Texas at Austin and author of The Impossible Presidency. And he was talking with Charles Monroe Kane.